So this is Thursday, the 3rd of May 2018, and I'm meeting Une Oak at his home in Golden Valley. And
Well, Golden Valley is just 2 hours away.
Oh, is that right? Yeah. Different address.
Different address.
Okay. So Une Oak and I have known each other for many, many years. And in fact, I wrote a chapter on Une Oak in a book that I wrote probably nearly 20 years ago. But Une Oak's life has been such an incredible story, I felt, for this oral history. It's very important to capture it. So thank you, Une Oak. And perhaps let's start wherever you'd like to start, at the beginning on the 11th of September 1943, if you like.
Well, of course, I never considered my life to be colourful at all, in a sense. I am a very ordinary man, but somehow, and just a teacher, my profession is just a teacher, but somehow I became so well known in this country. So it's wherever I go, some people know me by sight, but at least the others know me by name. So sometimes it surprises me. What have I done? I mean, to become a celebrity, well, in my country I am included in celebrities. To become a celebrity, I'm not a movie star. I did write, but not a top-notch writer, just a teacher.
But how many students do you have?
As a teacher, to be a celebrity is rather awkward. I find it rather awkward. But then, I had this school. I have to tell the whole story. It was so successful that most of the parents in Yangon and the suburbs sent almost all their kids to my school. That's how I became a celebrity famous. Well, let me start the story from the very, very beginning. Well, I was born in 1943, although my passport, my national identity says 1946. I don't know, something went wrong. And I tried to sort of correct it. It would take so many oath-taking and rechecking. I said, just leave it, because it doesn't bother me at all whether I'm 3 years younger or 3 years older. And since I'm not, I left the government service long ago. The government service is very important, of course. You can't sort of lie or cheat your age. You work till you are 60. But as a private, a professional, age doesn't really matter. I can retire when I like, whether I'm 60 or 63 really doesn't matter. So I was born actually on September 11th, 1953, in a very small town called Miao in Zagain region, that is next to the Mandi region, something like 2 hours, or rather 1.5 hours drive from Mandalay towards Mouyua. There's Mandalay Mouyua Road, and halfway there is a little lane, small road that goes into our small town. It's right on the Irrawaddy River. It's a very, very quaint little town, quiet little town, all farmers. That part of Myanmar, where they grow groundnut, sesame, corn, and many other things. So it's, I should say, not exactly a wealthy, but quite well-to-do town, because people there are basically farmers, and they grow all these crops, oil-producing crops, edible oil, peanuts and sesame. Even in those days, I believe they are valuable crops. So plenty of oil, plenty of food, and that's where I was born. Actually, my father was in the government service. Well, during that's wartime, 1943, so Yangon was evacuated. The Japanese have started bombing. And so the whole family, my father, the whole family is made of three, and my elder sister, my father decided to take his family back to his small town. And so I was conceived there, and I was born there. But my mother passed away 70s after I was born. And I was looked after by my father's sister. My mother's sister, younger sister, who later became professor of English, she accompanied my mum. So she was also, she was a spinster, of course, she was quite young then, I'm sure. And she also looked after me. So I was all looked after by my both maternal and paternal aunts.
Do you know, I suppose, if you describe your father, I wonder how your father and mother got together, because they're quite different.
Yes, that's a long, long story, which I have to relate to. But my father, coming from a small town, well, I might say in the middle of nowhere, just farmers. His father was a very wealthy landowner. He owned many, many acres of the agricultural land. His mother was very simple, grandma. I missed my grandma, but I saw my grandpa, because he lived to be 101. So with a very long hair with a hair knot at the back. Very generous man. And every evening, there were so many people in his compound. They just came to chat. And he would give them tea. And you know, we have pickled tea too. Also, green tea to drink, the plain tea. Plus, this pickled tea with all kinds of condiments, the beans and all kinds of beans. Because don't forget, he owned lots, I don't know, maybe hundreds and hundreds of acres of land that produces peanuts and all kinds of beans and pulses. So I noticed that green peas, yellow, white, you know, and oil. He owned some oil mills too. So food was plentiful. And he would serve that every day. Maybe at least there's something like visitors like 30 to 40 every evening. You know, they would go home when it became dark. But they would all come at sundown. You know, they enjoyed his plain tea. And he was a very old man, a real man, a wise man. They came to seek advice from him about how to sell, how to grow everything. So this was wonderful. I met him. And I was wondering how my father was educated in the London School of Economics. How did my father, from this town, get to the UK? I was so curious. So I found out that he was very clever, very smart, very bright student. So he went to this monastic school in his early schooling years. And then his father, well, he was a wise old man, sent his only son with five siblings, and he's the only boy in the family. So his father, being the only son, sent him to St. Peter's High School in Mandalay. I went to St. Paul's. It's the same group, the La Salle brothers. So he excelled, I suppose, in his studies. And after he finished his high school, he attended Yangon University and got his degree here. And then he was selected to study in England. They selected about five or six every year to finish another degree, a postgraduate degree in the UK, and to train them for the Indian Civil Service. They call it ICS in those days. And straight he would join. After he came back from England, he joined the British administration here, starting as a township officer, and rose up to a deputy commissioner and commissioner, and then permanent secretary of, the commissioner of customs, and then finally permanent secretary of defence. So he worked very hard, coming from a small town, because his English is okay, except, you know, the pronunciation is not very good. And his friends who studied together with him in England, you used to tell me your father's really hardworking. You see, he would study half the night with a big bowl of cool water beside him. As soon as he got sleepy, he would wash his face and continue studying. And he worked very hard, and he was one of the brilliant scholars. Everybody admired him. He was the first Myanmar commissioner for customs, and his reports still being studied. And he was the first Myanmar Secretary of Defense, and he was responsible for founding the Navy as well as the Air Force. And he did achieve many things. He was a leader. Bujok Aung really sort of admired him for his straightforwardness, he was running the ministry single-handedly, I suppose.
But he was a very conservative man.
Very conservative, no nonsense. And so when I got to a schooling age, he sent me to St. Paul's High School.
Yeah, you call it schooling as you're 9, I think, if I'm correct. You were only 9 years old, weren't you, when you were sent to...
No, not the boarding school yet. First, he sent me as a day scholar to attend the school. I mean, he chose St. Paul's because he studied at St. Peter's. We were all in one group. It was run by the same De La Salle brothers. So he sent me up. I joined it in grade 1. And by grade 3, he wasn't quite happy with my scholastic sort of achievements, because being the only... I was the only son again in the family, like himself. Totally spoiled. Although... my stepmother was a very kindly old lady, you see. And because I was spoiled by my aunts, all the maiden aunts from both sides, both maternal and paternal aunts, disappointed me. So I always, was unhappy with the curry that is cooked, with all the discipline at home. And my father, by the year I'm 9 year old, I think, in my third grade, he said, "No more. I have to send my son to a boarding school." So I was there at the boarding school at a very young age, and even my stepmother wept because she felt I was too young to be on my own. So I was there. I grew up with all these Irish priests. It was like a boot camp.
Could you go home at weekends? Or
no. Once a month. We were allowed to go home once a month. And, there, first, of course, it was such a difficult life. But then I adjusted myself quite well. I was quite happy there. In the end, I was happy with the food they served, although everybody complained. And, of course, my stepmother would send me all the pickles and all these, dry rations, which I could supplement if I didn't like the meals they served. So... in the end, I found it quite all right, although many complained. And there, I made many friends, and I also think made a lot of improvement in my studies. At home, I hardly studied.
And in fact, I think you still have friends from there, right? Like, so you were there for what, 6 or 8 years or something?
I started at nine years.
Yeah. And you still catch up with St. Paulians?
Yes, yes. Today. Well, I am the president of the alumni. They made me president for this 7th year. They said there won't be any election. I suppose I'll be a lifelong sort of president of the alumni, because I'm pally with everybody, my seniors as well as my juniors, so they like to keep me there. But we're in touch, you see. The wonderful thing is, every year we have this big event where we paid respects to our old teachers. Not many left, less than a dozen. They're in the 90s now, 80s and 90s. There are about 6 or 7 left. And after this ceremony in the morning, we had this get-together dinner in the evening. That was the fun. But lots of my school chums... came back from Australia, from UK, from Canada, from the States, everywhere. not every year, but every alternate year, every 3 years, it would come back and we would have a roaring time. It was good fun.
So how did your father meet your mother?
Well, again, this is... well, my father, he was posted in Prome, as a township officer. I think the district commissioner was my mother's eldest brother. Her family is different. My maternal grandfather was an administrator in the British colonial administration.
So he was also ICS?
Yes, no, he was not ICS. In those days, ICS was not. Before, well, the ICS was created only, I think, around 1930-something.
Okay.
So before that, the British governed our country, and the Burmese always take the junior sort of position. My grandfather, as far as I remember, was something like a township officer. I don't think he would be a deputy commissioner. He must be a township officer in Bago. And he trained his sons and daughters so well. It's amazing. All seven siblings became brilliant in their fields. Like the eldest son, Udintut, he was the first ICS. He studied in England, came back and became the first ICS, and also later Brigadier General in the British Army too, honorary. And he became the Minister for Finance, Minister for Foreign Affairs, and he was about to leave as a High Commissioner after independence, and he was killed. He was assassinated. He was Aung San's right hand man in getting the peace process, and finally, the both of them made a breakthrough in Binh. The agreement was signed, and we got the independence. Aung San always took my uncle along every time he went to the
UK. They weren't assassinated together.
No. He was in England when Aung San and the others were assassinated. He escaped the assassination attempt. But after 3 months, he was again assassinated. Somebody threw a bomb into his car. He exploded and he died. So he was one of the top politicians, a very, very clever man, and he was a dean list in Cambridge, I think. And that's my eldest uncle. So he was a deputy commissioner in Prome when my father was a township officer, his junior. And my mother came into the story. My mother was a college student. She was a poet, a renowned poet, a very famous poet. She wrote beautiful poetry. And sometimes my uncle, Dr. Tiao, the fourth uncle, who was the writer as well as the rector of the university, told me, "Oh, Mum, she's so good at writing poetry. But the problem is, after writing all these poems, usually she would sort of tore it up and threw it away." And my uncle had to sort of look at those fragments, put them together again, and copied it down. So that's why some of her poem sort of survived. But then she was in love with another poet, a very renowned Myanmar poet called Min Thu Won. And you know, when they came home for the summer holidays, my mother had to spend her summer vacation with her father, and when father passed away, she had to spend the vacation with the eldest brother who took the place of the father. And there was no way to communicate with each other in those days. So there was a journal, a very literary journal, a weekly journal. So through that journal, they would write poems to each other. So many people knew.
The two poets did?
Yes, the two poets. They never sort of write letters directly to each other, but they would send a poem to the journal, publish it, and the two poems all come together in the journal. So the whole country, the literary people were, you know, they were so excited. Every week they would read what she's doing in PA and what the the renowned poet would do he's from the Irrawaddy region, down south, and my mother was in Pier. So all these poems are now become classics, and we have to study them in the university and in the high school. So they were very much in love, but obviously my eldest uncle did not quite like the match. So final year came, my mother just finished her final year, and for the holidays she came back to spend her time with the eldest brother. Without any announcement, she was married off to my father. But she did not protest. She just took it. She must have been very sad, because after that, her poems were rather melancholy. And also, the great man wrote melancholic poems. But after 3 or 4 years, the poet married another Myanmar scholar. My mother settled down life of a high official, and my father was transferred back to Yangon and all that.
Your father must have known this, though, right? He must have known about this love affair or love.
Of course, yeah. I'm sure everybody knew it. Everybody knew. But then, my mother, I believe, was very, very beautiful. So my father wouldn't say no, I'm sure. And my mother also she settled down with this life. And my sister was born, and according to my sister, she was quite happy with her life. And then war broke out. My father had to take the family back to his small town where I was born, and 7 days after I was born.
Because it was dangerous to stay in Yangon at that time, during the Rangoon at that time, it was dangerous to stay during the war.
Yes, the Japanese started bombing, I believe, Yangon.
So how many years, what age did you come back to Rangoon?
Well, I was born there, and as soon as the war was over,
45.
My father had to come back. He was part of the government, and then I think he became Commissioner of Customs, and then when Bujo Aung San became Minister of Defence, he was asked to be his permanent secretary.
And how did he meet the stepmother? How did that happen?
I was very young then, of course. My stepmother's father was the district magistrate of Yangon. So again, a very high official. Because I saw the photos where my stepmother and her sisters attended to all the governor general's functions.
And had she been married before?
No.
So this was her first marriage.
What I understood was that my father had his eyes on the youngest daughter. She was also very pretty. All three daughters were pretty. They are Mun descent, Mun ancestry, so they are very fair and very, very beautiful. But my stepmother's father said the eldest daughter must be married first. So all three of them were pretty. So my father decided to marry the eldest daughter.
And from what you just said a little earlier, she wasn't the wicked stepmother we hear.
She's a very, very nice. I've read stories about wicked stepmothers. Yeah. My stepmother's not one of them. Maybe because I was the only son. She bore only three daughters, and one passed away. So in the family, we were two, my sister and my brother, my sister and myself. And she bore three daughters, one passed away. So two more sisters I had. So still, I was the only son.
And they're still around, your two, the three
yes,
sisters?
Yes. All of them are living in Yangon.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we could continue to talk about what happened after you finished schooling, what your father wanted you to do and what you wanted to do.
Those days, you see, those were the good days. You can be what you like to be, not like in the socialist era. So I haven't decided. I couldn't decide. But I was quite happy in school. So when I finished my high school, I went to the university, because most of my friends took science. So I took science, and my father was very happy. So when I took, I never liked to be a medical doctor.
But you passed. You finished your science.
Yeah, I could take any subject I like.
Yeah.
So I finished my science degree.
Degree.
So yeah. After the second year, then we had to decide where we want to go, medical or engineering or whatever. So I didn't want to be an engineer. My father wanted me to be an engineer. I didn't want to be an engineer. So I just studied pure science, as we call it, just physics and chemistry, and applied maths and all that. And I got a science degree. And then, somehow, my mother's blood to me, my mother's a poet. So I wanted to study literature so much. So I told my father, you don't need to pay me for my education. You've done your job. I've got my degree. So I can earn my own money. I was a writer by then. I was writing short articles about movies and many other things. So it's enough for me to go to 2 more years in college. And I got a Bachelor of Arts degree in literature, which I loved so much. And then I had to decide what I would like to do with an arts degree. So I thought foreign service was very lucrative. So I started studying international relations, and I went to the University of Foreign Languages and I studied French for 2 years. But then that was socialist time. Nepotism was so rife in every ministry, I couldn't get through. They recruited something like 2 or 3, or at most 4 every year, third secretary in the Foreign Service. So I was also not lucky. My first attempt, I was number 5. I missed it by 1. But anyway, the Public Service Commission said, try again. So I tried again. The next time, I stood 2nd. They selected 3, but then I was left out because all 3 were ministers' children. One of them, my friend, I was very upset.
And of course, your father, who probably could have helped you.
Oh, but he said no, no. At the time, the foreign minister was his director general of procurement at the defense. He was under him, an old man called Uthiha. I said, Dad, Uthiha is foreign minister. He said, no, you must never get into the service from the back door. Never, he said. Try. But I've been trying. But somehow, but that's your luck. Keep trying. So the third time I tried, I came out 1st. But it was the entire recruitment was cancelled that particular year. So I said, that's it. I was not destined to be a diplomat, although I liked to be a diplomat so much. And then at that time, I was already in the university, in the English department, because my aunt was the professor. So after I finished my exam, the final year, final day, my aunt said, you can come and teach. We are short of hands, a tutor. So I was teaching already when it was announced in the papers to recruit tutors. When I applied, of course I got it, I was already teaching by then. And then I was quite happy. After 1 or 2 years, I fell in love with the teaching job. And I was not so keen to be a diplomat. But yet, I did try for the third time. Because every time I took the exam, I need the endorsement of my minister. So I had to go to the minister. Here you come again. You don't like the service. Well, minister, I am not sure yet. Okay, so he was silent. And I missed it the third time, and I decided enough is enough. So I devoted teaching. I became very popular in university, so much so that my class was so full, my aunt had to come and said, you have to, the other teachers, there are only 4 or 5 in their classes. It was very ugly. My aunt said, from now on, you have to attend with your roll number, but no more.
Wasn't the case that you're offered a scholarship?
Yes, that
is that later. Come.
Yes,
that's even later.
So I think a year or two later, this scholarship in England for my PhD, so applied for it, and I got it. Because there were very few men. There were two, I think, candidates, the last, the shortlisted two. So the minister called me, and so he said, you're in the shortlist, and mostly women, there are only two men, and I would prefer to have a man professor of English. So, but frankly, I need a promise from you. You've been applying for this Foreign Service all the time, so it seems that you're using this job as a stepping stone. So at least you have to give me a promise, not a verbal promise, it's a signed promise that you would work in this department if you, when you come back with your PhD. I need a professor. There's no PhDs in English. So, do I have time to think? Okay, I'll give you this weekend. Let me know by Monday, he said.
And it was a number of years, wasn't it? It wasn't just 1 year.
No. The PhD is going to take me 3 to 5 years. No, I have to work in the education ministry for life, it seemed. That's a promise he wanted from me, a signed sort of a promise. And of course, there is also this, what we call a bond, where you had to work 10 or 20 years or something like that. There's a bond in those days.
Right.
But apart from that, do I have to sign? 10 years, I think. 20, I'm not sure. That do I have to sign? That is very binding. And upon that, he wanted me to promise. It so happened that I had started this small school very quietly. I'm not supposed to do it. I'm working for the government. But on the weekends, I had this small school, and the minister also knew that because he sent his two kids to my school. Because firstly, his philosophy is good. He said, it's a good thing that a university teacher would go down below his rank to teach high school students. That's a wonderful thing, you see, because we don't have, in those days even, enough teachers for high school. So that I do not sort of object. But it should not sort of, with your work, interfere with your work. I said, Minister, I teach there only on weekends. From Monday to Friday, and Saturday half day, I work at the university. Only Saturday afternoons and the whole of Sunday, I teach at my school. He said, fine. There's no objection. He knew that. And the school was getting popular too. And then, of course, I had to consult my father about this. So if I accepted the scholarship PhD, then I would be stuck there for life. I wouldn't be able to do anything. And I'd like to be more independent. And the school is doing already fine. So this could grow into a big one. I realized. I was already married then. So I went to ask my father. And my father said, but look at your family line. All your uncles and aunts, maternal side, all the four uncles, they are PhDs, all doctorates, and even the three, your mother died very, very young, your two aunts, scholars, and you should follow that line. But, she said, it's your life, you have to decide. If you ask me, she said, I think you should accept. But his last words were, it's up to you. You have to decide.
No pressure.
No pressure.
Oh, you don't think any pressure?
No.
I thought it was...
Yeah. No, he didn't. So I went home, I talked with my wife, and then I decided it's not worth it to give my entire life teaching the university. I was not that passionate about teaching, although I loved teaching. I could still teach outside the government service. So Monday, I went to see the minister and said, what's your decision? Decided not to take it, sir. Because my school is doing well, and one day I would like to quit the government service and start a proper school for English language, because here we're short of. And then many things. And then he said, and I had to ask him, did I make the right decision? You know what he said? Absolutely. because I noticed that you are very smart. You're very smart. I know the results of your Foreign Service exam and why you missed it, why you missed the appointment. So I know that whatever you do, I know that you do it very properly. So whether you get into the Foreign Service or any service, you're going to do well, for sure. So he said, congratulations. Go ahead. Start your own school. Make it grow. And then I wish him, wished me luck.
Was he a military?
No, he was the professor of geology, a doctorate, Dr. Nini, very, very smart. He went to join the UN. He's still living. He's still living.
Well, he must be.
Yes, I called on him. He's 90-something. I called on him in the UN, and he heard about my success in running a private school. He congratulated me. He said, I told you, didn't I, that you would do well. So, of course, it is a much satisfying job.
Yeah.
Because I had every year 4,000 to 5,000 students learning English from me. I couldn't have done it at the university. At most, I could take 3 or 4 classes, that's all.
So how many students do you think you've taught English? I mean, how many have gone through the school?
Well, more than 100,000. More than that. It's why enrollment I had to add up all over the years.
Wow.
Well, at least the second or third person I meet anyway turned out to be my old student.
No wonder that's how you're known. No one.
That's why I said it. Yeah. I couldn't believe a school teacher would become a celebrity.
But it wasn't all easy. I think you had some difficulties during your time. Oh,
the socialist times, I had a very difficult time. I paid my debts. I was heavily taxed. I paid that regularly. And many, but even at one point, the later ministers were generals. They said, this is one guy who is ruining the socialist education system. He pointed a finger at me and said that. But then, I was, you know, they gave a license every year. License was renewed every year. And I was contributing a lot to my little township. You know, whatever the township need, I contributed a lot of money to it. And although, well, officially they disliked me, they still sent all their kids to my school for English. All the general school kids were there with me. I didn't know, even some of the one my club will say that this is a kid of the chief of staff, maybe this is a son of chief of staff. I don't know the minister or something over there,
because of course with the Burmese names you can't tell.
And of course in their admission form, enrollment form, they always mention the name of the parents. Okay. Address. I never had time to go through that.
Sure.
5,000 enrollment, yeah. I couldn't go through that, so I wouldn't know. Everybody's equal to me.
And at one stage, though, weren't you arrested, or what happened?
Yes, it was again very funny. So, what happened was, this story. So, I saved quite a lot of money through this, you know, very legally.
Yeah.
And then there was one house by the lake, which was up for auction. There was a case. The owner died, and the wife, the second wife, fighting with the children of the first wife. See, for the property. It is a beautiful property, more than an acre, on the lake. It's so beautiful, and is therefore the court decided that the property should be sold. Half would go to the children, half go to the wife, the stepmother. So it was posted in the court. So to buy this house at auction, you need to have proper white money, as you call it. But I had a lot of money.
Legitimate money.
And a few doctors too. So I went there and I got it. So I was so happy. I came home. And then who heard this? Unewin. He's the next door neighbor, 2 houses away. his youngest daughter wanted this house for himself. She had already negotiated with the stepmother, the half owner of the house, and she wanted to pay a small amount. You see,
yeah.
When I paid the highest, I was the highest bidder, so I got it. So she complained to her father, and the father said, "Who is Neo? Oh, he is a private teacher. How did he make such a lot of money? Check his tax return." So everything was in order. And he just said that, and he told his minister, "How come you have this private teacher who is earning a lot of money in this socialist system? That there should be a law to control them." So our education minister at that time was a lawyer. He is a BL, a person who has a law degree, and he started drawing up this new law, private school teachers law, which is so ridiculous. Which was so ridiculous. You're not allowed to take more than 4 classes a day. And you're not allowed to take more than 10 chats a month, school fees.
It's like a cent,
and,
right?
And you're not allowed to have more than 20 students in your class. So it all added up to something like your earnings were 1,600 chats a month, which he said was equivalent to a brigadier general's pay. So we should be happy with that. So that law came out. The law passed it, just imagine.
It was passed.
It was passed. So my school's gone. I cannot have more than 80 students in my school. I can have only 4 classes, 20 each. That's it. So it's gone. And then the old man left for Switzerland for medical treatment one summer. And I was, after this law was came into force, I was arrested. So, but as I told you, all the general's children were my students. So they went to their father saying that, "Ah, teacher, why was he arrested?" So, and everybody thought the general ordered my arrest. But the chief of staff, I think, General Johnson, is a very kindly man. He said, "I will settle this when the old man came home. So just keep him in the hospital." So I was kept there. Hospital, saying that I'm supposed to be very ill, so not fit to be sent to In Sing jail. So I was kept there. There's a special ward for sick people there. They call it a guarded ward.
Full of non-sick people.
Yes. Some director generals do. I made friends with 2 or 3 directors general.
Because that's another thing, isn't it? It was like a badge of honor at that time.
Yes. So I was there. My wife could come. My son could come and see me. I was there for 90-something days. So when he came back, when the rain began, not by May, I think, by May or June, the old man came back, and then I think it was put up to a cabinet. The Prime Minister put it up. "We have arrested this school teacher. What shall we do with him?" The woman said, "Who asked you to arrest him?" So I was released the next day.
And what about the property?
Well, I didn't get it. So, well, while I was under arrest, you know what happened? Right. Of course, the man has been arrested and he probably go to jail. So we'll have a new auction. So they made a new auction and the girl got it. Nobody dared to sort of bid in that auction. She got it very cheaply, half of what I was supposed to be.
But the school, you never had to close down the school, even though that law was in.
No. Then, but in a smaller scale, I started again. But no.
Did you actually stop the school when?
For one year.
Really?
It was disrupted. So, but the next year I reopened again.
But had they cancelled the law, or was
no,
the law?
No, that law was never sort of practiced. It
right.
never came into force, because it's impossible.
Yeah.
How can you have only
4 classes?
Nobody could nobody could run a school with that kind of restriction. So it never came into force. It's still there, you know.
Is that right?
Yes, it's going to be sort of very soon going to be abolished. But it's still there. you're allowed to take only 10 jars, even now in the year 2018.
It's a cent or something now, yeah.
For a breach of anything, it's 3 years in jail. Finish. No fine. Straight to jail, 3 years. So this is the most rigid sort of law ever.
Yeah.
You can go to jail for
teaching. And you were never worried after that? After you...
Because the township people, the general administrative people says, okay, go ahead. We are not going to apply this law to your school.
And maybe now you could talk a little bit about your unusual uncles on both sides.
The first uncle was assassinated.
That's on your mother's side.
They are more prominent. They were very prominent, all four of them. The second uncle, who became Attorney General for a while, and then he was in politics. He was
what was his name?
Hu Chongmian. He's a barrister in law. He was very close with the Gandhi family. Very nice man, because I remember that when Indira became Prime Minister, she came to see him personally. He called him Papa G or something like that. So it was a big surprise. She requested General Nguyen that she wanted to see her old uncle. And one day the soldiers came and clear all the bushes and posted her around the compound. And my uncle thought he was going to be arrested.
How would they have met?
Well, during the war, I think my uncle, it wasn't politics. Somehow they were both India and Burma were struggling for independence.
Yeah.
So I didn't know the story. I must ask my cousin Johnny. He would know the story of his father's connection with the Gandhi family.
So he was
very prominent.
He became Attorney General.
Yes, and then he left the government service to practice law.
Right.
So his law firm was very successful. But he was a judge too. The panel, there was three judges, I think, who sentenced Usaw to death, gave a death sentence. He was the one.
Really?
Mango was the one, yes. Who was judge? There were three judges on the panel, I remember. He was the chief judge who sent Usaw to the gallows.
Okay. And Usaw, just for people who don't know, for people who are listening who don't know who Usaw was.
Well, the one who assassinated Aung San.
Aung San, yes. So that's the reason he was sent to the gallows.
Yes, right. Yes.
And then there's the other uncle.
After that, I think he quit the government service and became a lawyer. He practiced law. His was the most successful law firm.
Right. No, I was referring to one of the other uncles.
Well, the third uncle, of course, was more popular and more prominent. Chief Justice U Myint Thein, everybody called him Uncle Monty.
Why do they call him Monty?
Well, when he went to, what's he? Temple's Inn. It's so difficult to call him Myint Thein, so they called him Monty to make it more anglicized. And he came back with the English name Monty. Easier to call him Myint. Myint is very difficult to pronounce in English, I believe.
And he's also a lawyer.
Yes, and then he became, of course, justice and chief justice, and then he represented the UN. He was a permanent. He was ambassador to Nanjing and Beijing. That is very unusual. Again, he was there as our ambassador in Nanjing during Chiang Kai-shek's regime, and then after a year or so, the communist forces overran the country, and he was the one who sent the cable to UNU saying that this government is for good, because the people were all clamoring, welcoming the communists into the city, and UNU said, well, if you think so, go ahead and recognize it. So my uncle recognized it was the first country when other countries were pondering whether this new government would last or not. My uncle just went and said, we recognize you. So we became the first country to recognize the People's
Republic. And I
Republic
think that counted for a lot for many years.
Yes,
for
of
the
course
original government.
So, and Mao Zedong will always mention this
yeah
every time you talk about Burma in those days. And the two countries became very close. And my uncle Monty became a very, very close friend of Zhou Enlai.
Zhou Enlai, did he?
Yes,
okay.
Oh, very, very, and Zhou Enlai spoke English and French fluently, he told me. But he never kept interpreter.
Okay.
But for that's every it other official meetings, Zhou Enlai always speaks through the interpreter.
Right.
Never, you know, data. And he told my uncle, see, there is a big advantage in keeping an interpreter. One, it gives you time to think. So when another head of state asked a question, while the interpreter is interpreting, he knows the language, he knew the language better than his interpreter, he would be thinking the answer. It gave him a little more time to think of an answer. And two, he said, if I give a wrong answer, I will always blame the interpreter. He interpreted all wrong. So my uncle said, very wise man.
So that's three, there's four. So
the fourth uncle was Dr. Tin Au, who was a very famous writer of books, folk tales and lore tales and Burmese drama. He was a rector. And he is also a real academic, a marvelous man. He was given a scholarship to England, but he finished his thesis in less than a year when he got his PhD. Actually, it was a 4-year. So he refused to go home. One after another of PhDs, ended up with 4 or 5 when he came back. Even the last one, he wanted to take one more, law. So he got gold medal for all the PhDs. He sold off all the gold medals and stayed on for another 9 months to get his law, barrister of law. So he came home with 5 doctorates.
And what did he do there?
And first, when the British left after independence, he was a professor of English, professor of philosophy, professor of sociology, professor of anthropology, professor of history, and also professor of law, I think.
So not interested in money at all.
No.
An academic.
No. So he was professor of 6 departments in the university.
And I think I may be wrong, but I thought you were particularly close to him. Is that right?
Well, we're all close to, because Uncle Monty, starting from Uncle Monty, bore no children. This uncle bore no children. So we were very close with these 2 uncles. All the nephews and nieces would visit them on Sunday, listen to their stories.
They married but no children?
No children.
Wow.
They bore no children. So it was great fun. But talking to this particular uncle, he had so many funny stories to tell.
And were they, they close to your father as well?
They were very close to my father. They used to come and visit my father too, although my mother had passed away.
And, of course, they were on your mother's side, and your father's only had, what you say, a sister, sister in...
My father had 4 sisters.
They
never left
right
their town. It was, they led such a simple life.
Right.
I was sometimes, I wonder it might be better to live there because everything is so, life was so simple.
Yes.
Like they never existed a restaurant too. You see, when they go up to Manly, one of the daughters or sister would like to dine at the restaurant. And she was looked down. She said, why would you like to go to a restaurant where there would be many strangers there? To dine with strangers, that's for a lady to dine with strangers among restaurants, that's not proper, they used to say, because there were no restaurants in the town, small town. There were restaurants in Manly, which is about, I told you, 1.5 hours drive. And one of my cousins, of course, daughter, she attended the university, and she was quite, this is over-modernized, they used to say, just for dining at a restaurant. It was so simple. Everything was simple.
Still is,
oh,
probably.
Wonderful.
Still is probably simple.
But yes, still is.
Now, you mentioned just you've got a cousin who you said might know what has happened to someone. So one of your uncles on your mother's side must have had children.
Yes, the eldest, my eldest uncle, had three daughters. One still is still living. Okay. She's in Washington, D.C. Two passed away. And the second, Uchonmian, has five children. Johnny Theop is one of them, and he had three sisters living.
What's his name?
Theop.
Oh, Theop. So there is the Oak name has.
Well, I don't know. Mine came. You know, I was named by my grandfather, but I told you I met my grandfather.
Yes,
he lived to be 101. I was born at the end of 1943 when the Japanese were being defeated, or rather about to be defeated. My grandfather said, that is a very good omen. Your son was born. And I'm sure in a few years' time we will defeat it. So let's call him Nei-O. Nei is son. That's the Japanese symbol. O is to overcome, to rule, to conquer.
Uh-huh.
So this son, your son, brings this good omen that he will be, that the era has come, the Japanese will be defeated.
So,
and I was born on a Saturday. Well, Saturday we have to choose the name. Na. And Sunday, I was born late in the evening. Ah, it's Sunday. So I was born, 1.5 hours more, it would be Sunday. So I took both the Saturday alphabet and the Sunday alphabet.
So Nei.
Nei is for Saturday. Ah is for Sunday.
Yeah, but Nei you said means what?
Sun.
Okay.
O is to govern, rule,
okay.
Conquer.
Okay, but one of your cousins was also given the name
Oak. Well, he is Theok, but I don't know why his father named him Theok. I had to ask him. The Oak is not a family name. No,
because you don't have family
names.
No. Yeah. So your son, what name did you give him?
I just used the Nei.
Nei.
Nei So, because he's Tuesday born.
Tuesday born. Okay. And so I think you've now stopped the teaching.
Well, yes, almost, except I've only one class which I am trying to apply the new the method. So I still have one class left. So that is just like a pilot sort of class.
And you seem to be doing national service now.
It seems so.
So what is it?
Well, I'm helping the Minister of Education, also Aung San Suu Kyi in education. And now, foreign relations too. She asked me to attend all these international conferences, human rights, and where Rakhine issue is being sort of debated.
And that involves you doing a lot of international travel now, more than ever.
More than ever, and I have to read a lot about international relations too. The other day, I was given these books to read. About China. 3-4 books.
In English or
in English, of course. Yeah. In English. So I even told my friends, I rather read Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice for the third or fourth time rather than China's Belt and Road.
And just to finish, so, you know, on the education side, how do you see things progressing here?
Well, of course, we have started our reforms, you see, 3 years ago. And this academic year, that means 2018-19, we're going to do the second grade. And next year, 2019-20, we're going to do three grades. But it'll be completed, it'll be done by 2022-23. So we're going to get grade by grade. But some people feel it's very slow, but education, you can't do it overnight. This is the problem. We're changing the methodology, new curricula, training the teachers, it's a big job.
And there is one final thing that in the chapter on you that I wrote before was about, you talked about at the end of his life, your father, you felt...
Yes.
Well,
I wonder... I wish my father were alive. You know, when he passed away, I was already a very successful you know, educator, let's put it. I have the school, and I was making a lot of money. And he was stricken with cancer, prostate cancer, and medication was very difficult to get because medication, it's a short lived. The expiry comes in 3 months or so. So I had to order from the States. I had to pay in hard currency. So at least I was very happy that I could look after him, sort of give him those very expensive and very hard to get medication from the States. So in his last days, one of his last days, and he was talking about, he came to look at my new house which was being built in Windermere, where you interviewed me for the added value book, and he went home quite happy that his son was doing quite well.
So you feel
I felt that it was time for me to ask him. So I asked him, Dad, did I make the right decision of not taking the PhD scholarship? He didn't reply.
Oh my goodness.
He didn't reply.
He's a tough guy to lead.
Very tough. And now, I just told you, I wish you were like, because I'm now doing a PhD thesis.
Oh, are you?
Yes, for the Dublin University, University of Dublin. One of my uncles got his PhD about the difficulties in teaching English to our different ethnic groups. You know, each ethnic seems to have its problem. Some have difficulty pronouncing F, some S, and all these. I've noted down in my diary over the years, and I found it again, and I think this would make a good thesis. So I made a summary and sent it to Dublin, and they accepted it. Please finish it, and please come put it up, and we will award you a PhD.
You'll have to do it as fast as your uncle.
Yes.
So, Unayo, thank you so much for chatting to us about your life. I'm sure many people will find it inspiring. So, thank you very, very much. Thank you.
And a little postscript about the story of my mum and the poet. So, I talked about it in the TED Talk. I was the first speaker from Burma in TED Talk. The TED started last 2016. I was the first speaker. So they asked me to tell something about Myanmar poetry. So I thought it would be a good thing because my mother was a poet.
Yeah.
And all this story, I didn't reveal, everybody knew who the poet was, because the children are still living. And then after TED Talk, 3 months after TED Talk, the poet's son became our president, Utenjo.
The current president?
Yes, he's retired, of course. Now we have a new president.
The last president?
Yes, the last president.
Was the son of?
Son of, yes.
How incredible.
So it was difficult to mention the names. And one person asked me, why didn't you sort of mention the names of? No, I said, I want them to be immortal. So I will immortalize them if I continue about the stories. Let them be immortals.
That's a wonderful postscript. Thank you very much. Thanks, Nayo. Thank you.
Following my interview with Lou Nayok, I sat there for a while chatting to him, and something made me look around the room. And I saw that basically in a very large room, it's wall to wall with DVDs, movie DVDs. There must be thousands of them there. And it jogged my memory that in the last month, I had been chatting to an old Burmese friend who's 80 years old, who told me that for a period of time, he and his wife, just ordinary civil servants, were invited to General Ne Win's home for dinner on Saturday night with others. And following dinner, they all sat down and watched the latest blockbuster Hollywood movie. Now, this absolutely shocked me because I understood that, foreign things were either banned or not looked on favourably. So I thought this was quite extraordinary, and I recounted this to Unayok, who roared with laughter and said, "Didn't you know? I selected the movies for General Ne Win." I said, "Come on, what do you mean you selected the movies for General Ne Win?" He said, "Well, you may have heard me mention in the interview that when I was young, still at school, I started writing. And I wrote stories, but I also did reviews of movies. Well, apparently, General Ne Win read one of my reviews of a particular movie and thought that my view was exactly the same as his. So he thought, this person knows the sort of movies I like. He should be on our censorship board. So he instructed his aide-de-corps to go and find Unayok and duly appoint him to the censorship board. So the aide-de-corps managed to track down where Unayok lived and went to the door, knocked on the door. And of course, Unayok's father opens it up and is shocked to see senior military people at the door. At that time, you'd never know why they were there. You could have been taken off. Anything could have happened. So they then said, "Well, we'd like to see Unayok." And that, of course, worried Unayok's father even more. But he duly called his son, and down came Unayok. And the military people were absolutely shocked because they could see this was just a young kid, 17-year-old kid. And they said, "Are you Unayok who writes the reviews?" And he said, "Yes, that's me." And they decided there and then that they couldn't go back to General Ne Win and say, "Hey, this man's, it's only a boy who writes these reviews." But they appointed Unayok at the age of 17 to join the censorship board. Now, above Unayok, obviously, there are a lot more senior people, and two in particular were really in charge of vetting the movies that went to General Ne Win's home. And Unayok knew that General Ne Win absolutely loved all of the James Bond movies. And the first one was Dr. No. The next one came out, and for those who are old enough to remember, it was called From Russia with Love. Well, the two senior people said, "We can't possibly send this to General Ne Win because it's obviously anti-Russian, anti-Soviet, anti-socialist. We cannot use or allow General Ne Win to see this movie." But Unayok knew that that was just the title, was just a fun title. So without telling his two senior censorship people, he changed the title from Russia with Love to something like From 007 with Love and sent it off to General Ne Win for viewing. Well, General Ne Win absolutely loved the movie and came back to absolutely loved the movie and sent his aide-de-corps back to tell the senior people how much General Ne Win had enjoyed the movie. Well, as Unayok told me, from that day on, he never had any difficulty in deciding what movies to select for General Ne Win. Now, I hope I've told or recounted the story accurately, and no doubt if Unayok listens to this podcast one day, if I've made any errors, he will let me know.